good to see you all this evening, and we're always thankful to be together with God and with God's people. We're going to continue our studies in the Minor Prophets tonight. We're down to the last one that I've got slated to cover, and that's the book of Malachi. It's one of the shorter Minor Prophets, not the shortest, but one of the shorter ones. But it's going to take us two lessons to cover it because he raises quite a few issues in there that are of interest to us. I want to talk about the timing of when Malachi most likely prophesied, the timing of the writing of his book. Malachi chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, a son honoreth his father and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts, O you, unto you, O priests that despise my name. And you say, wherein do we despise thy name? You offer polluted bread upon mine altar, and you say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. Now, you might be looking at that saying, what on earth does that have to do with telling us when Malachi might have prophesied? Well, this is an example where you don't have a lead pipe cinch locked down statement in the book that says he prophesied during the reign of thus and such king or something like that. We don't have that. We do have some clues that'll get us pretty close to a good date for when Malachi would have prophesied. Observe here, he talks to the priests as though they were presently functioning in their priestly work. That means that this was at a time when the priestly rituals, the sacrifices and all, had already been resumed. And the tone of the language is that they'd been resumed for some time, because they'd been resumed for long enough to be going along and then have turned sour and them doing it wrong. And you say, resumed from what? Remember, Israel or Judah had been in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. And when they came back, the temple was in ruins and the sacrifice ritual was all that was all on hold. And there was a period of time during prophets like Ezra and Nehemiah and other prophets of God like Haggai and Zechariah that were working with Judah to restore all this. Now we're at a time when it appears to have been restored. He mentions the altar as being in place. He mentions the table of the Lord there, although they were corrupting the worship. The furnishings and the rituals were in place. And that's not the only statement we have in Malachi that gives us this hint. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, he says in Malachi 3 and verse 10, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open to you the windows of heaven and pour out to you a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Now here he talks about them paying tithes and bringing it to the storehouse. And he talks about God's house. That's the temple. So this tells us that by Malachi's time, the temple had been rebuilt. Now when we look at the history of Judah, they had been in Babylonian captivity till about 536 B.C. And then from that time forward, they were ruled by governors, men like Nehemiah. And the book that bears his name gives us history of this window of time. Also the prophets Haggai and Zechariah prophesied at that time. With an examination of these books compared with what is known from secular history, scholars believe that that temple was rebuilt somewhere in this window of time right here. And that tells you somewhere roughly from 500 B.C. to about 470, 460 B.C., somewhere along in there. All right, so Malachi would had to have come sometime after this period of time because he was working at a time when the temple had been restored and the sacrifice ritual and the worship ritual had been resumed. Now there's something else we can observe about Malachi, and that is his circumstances are very similar to those that are found at the end of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah deals with mixed marriages, that is the people of Judah marrying pagan wives. That's in Nehemiah 13. We've got that issue in Malachi 2. Nehemiah deals with corrupt priests doing a corrupt work, and we see that dealt with in both books. Nehemiah dealt with the neglect of tithes, and Malachi talks about that in particular in chapter 3. Nehemiah dealt with Sabbath violations, and Malachi talked about that as well in Malachi chapter 3. So it appears that the circumstances of the book of Malachi match the circumstances at the end of the book of Nehemiah. And that works because that would have been sometime after the temple had been reconstructed. Now what do we know about the date of Nehemiah? We don't have a statement in Malachi to give us the date. We do have a statement at the end of the book of Nehemiah. by the end of the book of Nehemiah, and it's a book that covers several years, so we want to know about the date at the end of the book, the same chapter 13 that parallels Malachi, it says in verse 6, "In all this time was not I at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king." So he talks about the 32nd year of the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon. And historians believe that that is Artaxerxes Longomanus. There was different ones in that Xerxes or Artaxerxes family. And it's believed that this is Artaxerxes Longomanus, or the long-handed. That's what his name means. He had abnormally long hands and long fingers. He ruled from this window of time you see represented on the screen, approximately 460 B.C. down towards about 407 B.C., something like that. Well, you can do the math. The 32nd year of his reign would have been here towards the end of his reign, and that brings us down here after the temple would have been finished, right here around 410, 420, something like that B.C. That's a comfortable window of time to place the book of Malachi. It's consistent with the internal circumstances that we find in the book. As far as I know, it doesn't violate what we know about biblical history in any of the other books. Now, I know that it's not a salvation issue knowing when Malachi was written. It does help us to understand his message a little bit better, to understand that he was the last of the Old Testament prophets. That puts a little different spin on it. But I hope that this approach helps illustrate to you different ways and strategies that we can use to investigate these books as we study them. Malachi deals primarily with the people of Judah, and the city of Jerusalem there, and the Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, all that era of time there. Now, let's look at the name Malachi. It says, "The burden of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi." There's some speculation that that may not have been his literal given name, but rather a representative or symbolic name. And the reason for that is that name Malachi means the same thing that's said in Malachi 3 and verse 1, when he said, "I will send my messenger and he'll prepare the way before me." Now, in our next study on Malachi, we'll talk more about this passage in greater detail. For now, let me just say that Malachi 3 and 1 foretells the work of John the Baptist coming and preparing the way for Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and his personal ministry here on earth. And so, as there was this messenger to prepare the way for the Lord, the idea is that Malachi's name is a play on words to say he's the messenger to set the stage for the coming messenger who would prepare the way for the Lord. That just like he foretold of a preparatory messenger, a voice crying in the wilderness, to compare it to Isaiah's language, that he also was fulfilling that function. And that's a reasonable point of view for us to consider. Malachi is a harbinger that Old Testament things are winding down. Israel had already been kicked out. The northern kingdom, they'd already been wiped out. Judah had been in an awful lot of trouble with God. He brought them back and let the homeland be restored. The stage is being set for God's scheme of redemption to unfold its next major phase, and that is the phase of God's Son coming into the world to carry out his redemptive work. So in that sense, we can see Malachi as that messenger prophet who says there's another big phase coming. In our view that the book was written near the end of Old Testament times, approximately 400 B.C., certainly allows for that. Now let's go to Malachi 1, verse 2 and 3. He said, "I've loved you, saith the Lord, yet ye say, wherein hast thou loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord? Yet I loved Jacob and hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness." Well, Judah apparently was having some sort of complex. They were questioning God's love for them. Well, that sounds silly to us, and admittedly, it probably was silly, especially given God's response to it, which we'll analyze momentarily. But look at it this way. Think in a big gulp of Judah's history. They'd just been sent off to the land of Babylon for a 70-year spanking. Their homeland was laid waste. Their capital city was razed to the ground. The temple that they treasured and adored, that was the center of their worship, the prophets of God depicted God leaving that temple, leaving way for the enemy to come in and wipe it out. And wipe it out they did. The city fell in the most unhappy fashion. There was widespread famine. There was cannibalism. There were fires. It was an awful, awful scene. Now, yes, they deserved every bit of that. They had turned their back on God and served idols. But now they are looking back across that window of history. And you know, it's like when a child is punished. They may have deserved their punishment, but sometime that child may feel a sense of doubt in their parents' love while they're under that punishment. And what do parents do? They step in and they reassure their children, well, we love you, but we're going to hold you responsible for what you do. And that's what God is doing with Judah here. He's saying, you question my love for you, I'll prove my love for you, but I'm also going to prove why I've got a right to be upset with you. So he starts out by comparing their circumstance with that of the Edomites. He says, was not Esau Jacob's brother? Yet I loved Jacob and hated Esau. Well, that particular citation has been the unfortunate source of a lot of controversy, and some false teachers have twisted that to try to contort it into something that God never taught, never said, never meant. And that is the Calvinist point of view that basically says Jacob here represents people that are elect, the ones that God foreordained, you guys are going to be saved. And Esau is an example of people that God said, you're lost in sin. I'm not going to help you. Jesus didn't die for you. You're just going to go to hell, and I really don't care. Now, that's the Calvinist point of view. And that is a doctrine that is resurging amongst different denominations and being taught in a lot of theological seminaries today. Well, that doctrine was heinous centuries ago when Calvin cooked it up, and it's just as ugly today. This does not teach that God favored Jacob as an individual over Esau as an individual. This isn't talking about Jacob and Esau as individuals. It's talking about the nations that they represented. Jacob fathered the nation of Israel, of which Judah was a part. And Esau fathered the nation of Edom. And God is saying, I've given you a favored position among the nations over the Edomites. That's proof that I love you, that I care about you. Let's examine this a little bit more closely. Does that mean that Israel was God's chosen people? Absolutely. Isaiah 45 and verse 4. Jacob, my servant's sake, and Israel, mine elect. I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. So here he refers to Israel as God's elect. Now, in the speak of the Calvinist doctrine, if you're one of the elect, that means you're irrevocably saved. That before the world was ever created, God elected, okay, I'm going to save Ken Farr. And there's nothing that can happen that will change that. Ken will make the choice that he will do what's necessary in order to be saved, and he will not fall from that. That's Calvinism in a nutshell. That because somebody is elect, that means they're saved and it can't be revoked. But what we learn here is that election is not of a particular individual, Jacob, but it's of a whole nation. And individuals within that nation could make choices that would cause them to be lost. Romans 11 talks about that. In verse 20, he said, well, because of unbelief they were broken off, and thou standest by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. For if God spared not the natural branches, take heed lest he also spare not thee. Now study that in its context, and you'll learn that Paul is talking about the nation of Israel that was God's elect. And what happened to some of them? They were cut off because of unbelief. Well, this is proof positive of somebody that was elect being severed from God because of their unfaithfulness. So evidently, being elect by God is not about some irrevocable decree that this person is saved, as the Calvinist doctrine teaches. But the elect is a group, a type of people. Today, the church is the elect. And you can make individual choices that will make you a part of the church, or you could make an individual choice that would cause you to turn away from the church and leave God's people and no longer serve God. Whether or not somebody is a part of the elect is a choice that they make. So God isn't saying that I elected or caused Jacob as an individual to be saved. He's talking about Israel as a whole. Deuteronomy 21, verse 15 to 17. If a man have two wives, one beloved and the other hated. Now you might be wondering, well, why are you reading this law about how a guy was to treat his two wives? Well, here's why. Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. That word hate, the word that's translated hate there, does not always mean, I hate your guts. You're going to be lost. I don't care about you. Sometimes, like the Greek equivalent in the New Testament, it's a term of ranking. It's not that God didn't love Esau. He favored Edom and gave them a blessing. Go back in Genesis and read the history. And they fared well as a nation because God cared about them. But he didn't give them the same exalted status that he did Israel. So when he says, I love Jacob and I hated Esau, he's giving a ranking of where they stood as a people, as a nation with God. Just as he's talking here, he's using the same word translated hated there to talk about the ranking of two wives in a polygamous marriage. He's talking about a guy, he has one wife that he favors over the other one. It's not that he literally hates the other one, but she's below the first one in ranking. Now let's talk about the honor. God has proven his love for them by explaining, I've given you this exalted status above other nations, such as the nations of the nation of the Edomites. Now let's talk about why God is upset. Malachi 1, beginning at verse 6. A son honoreth his father and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith the Lord of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein have we despised thy name? Ye offer polluted bread upon my altar. And ye say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that ye say, the table of the Lord is contemptible. What is God telling them? You're all twisted off here thinking that I hate you, but look at what you're doing. You're not honoring me. Why? Because they weren't worshiping God correctly. You see, it was really them that had a problem in their relationship with God. He goes on to say, if you offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? If you offer the lame and the sick, is it not evil? Offer it now to thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee or accept thy person? He goes on to argue, Would somebody, a civil ruler, accept being treated the way you treat me? You know, we think about this. This really speaks a powerful message. God expects our best, not our second best. Think about that. God expects your best. I'd like to ask you a question. Are you giving God your best right now? He says, go ahead and try to offer something second-handed or slack or tainted to your governor or somebody else in your life that you would honor. See how well they would accept it. But you people expect me to accept it when you give me the lame and the blind and so forth like that. He concluded in this particular section by saying, neither will I accept an offering at your hand. I'm not going to take it. We can give God second best all we want. That doesn't mean he accepts it. There's a powerful message in the warning that God gives to Judah in this time. Then he goes on and talks about the Gentiles. He's provoking Judah to jealousy with this other nation. He said, from the rising of the sun even to the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. And in every place incense shall be offered unto my name and pure offering. For my name shall be great among the heathen, saith the Lord of hosts. You know all those people of Esau that God hated, meaning as a nation they were ranked less than Israel? He said, they're going to have a chance to be saved. They're going to have a chance to offer sacrifices to God. Now stop and think about that. He's telling Judah, you guys have rebelled, you guys aren't worshiping right, I'll find people that will. And those people that he would find were the Gentiles. My name will be great among the Gentiles. Well, now, how's that going to happen? Are Gentiles going to physically come join the physical nation of Judah? No, that's not the point at all. Look, that language goes back to the Abrahamic promise at the very beginning when God promised to Israel's ancestral grandfather as a great blessing. He told them that blessing would touch all the earth. Genesis 12 and 3, I'll bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. The original promise to Abraham makes it clear that the status of being God's chosen people would not be Israel's exclusive property. They thought it was then, and some of them still think that now, but they were wrong then and they're wrong now. They've turned a deaf ear to the Abrahamic promise, which in clear language says this blessing to Abraham is to include us Gentiles as well. That's right. It's always been in God's plan to include Gentiles. And you study throughout the prophets, when you study about the blessing of future salvation coming at the hands of the Messiah, you're going to find just what you find in Malachi. That blessing is going to the Gentiles as well as to the people of Israel. It's not exclusively Israel's property, but it's a promise that belongs to the world. In Genesis 22 and 18, God reiterated the promise to Abraham when he said, "In thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice." We find the same thing in the other prophets, as I said. For example, in Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2, "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow into it." All nations, not just Israel. It's been the prophetic message all along that Gentiles would be welcomed by Messiah into his kingdom. Now, what happened in the first century? When the gospel broke ranks and left the nation of Judah and was carried to the Gentiles, and you've got Cornelius and his family obeying the gospel in Acts chapter 10, all those Jewish Christians were in an uproar. What? You mean Gentiles can have this blessing too? Yes, that was the promise all along. It was the promise to Abraham, and it was a promise that was reiterated throughout the prophets, that the saving work of the Messiah would reach beyond just the nation of Israel and unto all the world. God's reason for the honor that they should give him, God's reason for demanding their loyalty, he said, "Cursed be the deceiver which hath in his flock a male and vowed and sacrificed unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen." God says, if you've got an acceptable sacrifice, and you act like you don't have that good animal, so you can give a blind animal and keep the good one for yourself or whatever like that, he says, that's not going to fly, because I'm a great king. Look, there's something that we just have to accept about God, and some people don't want to accept it. And that is, he is a great king. He's the king of heaven. He's our creator, and he has the right to demand whatever he wants. And if he wants to demand your best and refuse to accept your leftovers, then that's his prerogative. That's just how it is. There's a lot of people in the world that don't understand that. We expect that there. But we should know. We should understand that God in his greatness has the right to demand our best. Now let's look into chapter 2. Part of Malachi chapter 2 deals with the issue that we studied some this morning, the issue of divorce. So there'll be part of this I don't spend as much time on, because we spent time on it this morning. But we will give it a review. Malachi 2, the first two verses says, "Now, O ye priests, this commandment is for you. I will not hear, and if ye will not let, if ye will not hear, and if ye will not lay it to heart to give glory to my name, saith the Lord of hosts, I will even send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already, because you do not lay it to heart." What is God saying? He's saying, I'm talking to you, and I want you to listen. I want you to lay this to heart. Have you ever been talking to somebody about something that was really important and you just felt like it wasn't soaking in? I'm sure my parents felt that way about me an awful lot. And the reason they felt that way is because sometimes it wasn't soaking in. I hope by now a lot of it did, but you know, back at the time, not all of it did. I feel that way sometimes preaching. I'll look out in the audience and I'll see somebody and I'll think they're just not engaged. They just don't care. It's just not soaking in. I'm sure others feel that way about me at times. They're trying to plead some case with me and get me to understand their point of view. That, you know, we don't want to be that way with God. We need to take what the Lord teaches in his word, and we need to give ear to it, and we need to lay it to heart. We need to let it sink deep inside us. God's always demanded that of his people. Look at Deuteronomy 11, verse 18. He said, "Lay up these my words in your heart and in your soul, and bind them for a sign upon your hand, that they may be as frontlets between your eyes." What does God say? He says, take this word that I'm giving you and let it sink deep inside. Bind it to your soul. How much deeper can it go than that? Jesus said the same thing in his preaching in Luke 9 and 44. "Let these sayings sink down into your ears. For the Son of Man shall be delivered into the hands of men." He's trying to plead with them to listen. God's always been trying to plead with his children, to plead with humankind, listen. Because he wants to help us. And he has words that will help us if we'll listen, if we'll let them sink in. And then he goes on and talks about their cruelty. And this is the issue we discussed this morning. Have we not all one Father? Have not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, by profaning the covenant of our fathers? They were dealing treacherously. They were cruel. They were cruel to their national brothers, and they were cruel to their wives. They were cruel. They dealt treacherously in that they didn't regard their agreements, but they broke their agreements. And he's saying, didn't God create us all? We shouldn't treat each other this way. He's getting ready to go into this section about how they just heartlessly divorced their wives just to go get another wife for no good reason. They just wanted to go get a pagan wife. And he says, God created you and he created that woman over there that you're married to. You ought to treat her right. Your fellows in the family of God are partners in the family of God. And then he goes on and complains about them dealing treacherously and an abomination that's committed in Israel. And what is that? They married the daughters of a strange god, just like we talked about this morning. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacle of Jacob, and him that offered an offering to the Lord of hosts. And this have ye done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering anymore, receiveth it with good will at your hand. He says, I'm not accepting your offering. I don't receive your worship because of what you're doing. Covering the altar of the Lord with tears, that's the tears of these young wives that they were mistreating. Read on. Yet ye say, wherefore, and in what way have we done this? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against thou, whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion, the wife of thy covenant. And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one, that he might seek a godly seed. Wherefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously. Say, watch your heart. Don't have this cruel heart and this cruel spirit that's willing to so casually put away the wife of your youth and break that covenant. Now, when you look in the law, they had provisions for divorce. Deuteronomy 24 allowed for that in the first four verses. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. What was the circumstance under which God would allow a man of Israel to divorce his wife? If he's displeased because he's found some uncleanness in her. Now that word that's translated uncleanness, we could spend a two-hour lecture explaining different ways that that word is used. And I'm going to try to reduce that to one simple concept. That basically means some extreme cause of shame. Now, some people look at that and say, well, that must mean that they got married and he found out that she wasn't a virgin when they got married. Well, that's not the case because the law had provisions for that. And the law said such a woman was to be stoned to death. And this woman could go be another man's wife. Somebody else says, well, that's probably when she committed adultery. If she had an affair, that was that cause of uncleanness. No, because if she committed adultery, she was to be stoned to death. She couldn't go and become another man's wife. Here's the idea. They couldn't just put her away for burning the biscuits. There had to be some extreme cause of shame. It had to be a serious, serious problem. And the people in Malachi's day were abusing that concept and were getting divorced for any and every reason just because they wanted to go get another wife. And God said, I'm not going to accept this. This covenant, your marriage, this is a serious deal. In Genesis 21 and verse 10, he has allowed divorce under certain circumstances. She said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. This is Sarah talking to Abraham, saying, you need to divorce Hagar. Because there were some problems in the family, and Hagar was part of the problem. She wasn't the only problem, but she was part of it. And Sarah, being sort of the ranking wife, if I could put it in those terms, she married Abraham first, and she was the mother of the promise. God had made that promise to Abraham. He made it to Sarah as well. She said, you need to divorce Hagar. Abraham didn't want to do it. You know what God told him? Do it. God allowed Abraham to divorce Hagar. Put her out. She was done. So it's not that there was no circumstance under which that could happen, but those circumstances were to be limited. And there were some extreme problems in the case of Abraham and Sarah there with Hagar. In Isaiah 50 in verse 1, Here he talked about the Lord giving Israel a bill of divorcement. Where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities have you sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away. Talking about God saying, I've divorced Israel, like we talked about this morning. We reviewed that in Jeremiah 3 in verse 8, where God put away Israel. He divorced her. He gave her a bill of divorcement. So again, the idea is not that it could never happen, but in the circumstances that prevailed in Malachi's day, it was divorce for pitiful excuses, and they had no respect for the idea that their marriage covenant was to be permanent. And they were breaking the hearts of these young wives, and God says that's wrong. And in doing that, they were trying to blur the line between good and evil. In Malachi 2 and verse 17, he says, you've wearied the Lord with your words, yet you say, wherein have we wearied him? When ye say, everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in him. And, or where is the God of judgment? You know, people always want to blur the line between good and evil when they're bent on doing something wrong. We always want to fuzzy the line and start talking about gray this and gray that, and there's no black and white, and there's no moral absolutes, because God is a God of love, so let's not say that something is wrong. Who are we to condemn some particular action or lifestyle? And on the song drones. And it's wrong. And it was wrong 2,400 years ago when they did it in Malachi's day. And in Malachi's day, they did it for the same pitiful excuse that people are doing it today, because they want to justify themselves doing what they want to do. Because they wanted to divorce this one and go find a different wife that was a pagan wife, because they wanted to do what they wanted to do instead of what God wanted to do, the line between right and wrong was blurred, and everybody that does evil is still good in the sight of the Lord. And we hear that today. Every kind of immoral lifestyle is upheld as, well, that's still right in the sight of the Lord. It's still okay. God won't condemn that, really. Even though he's warned us repeatedly in his word that he will. We need to understand the root reason, the root motive behind that kind of mentality. It's the same as it was in Malachi 2 and 17. It's an attempt to cover shameful conduct. And God wouldn't tolerate it with Malachi or with the people in Malachi's day. Why do you think he'd be any different today? From this first study of the book of Malachi, we've seen some important principles that come to light. We recall that Acts 13 and 27 is a challenge to remember the things we learned from the prophets. They that dwell at Jerusalem and their rulers, because they knew him not, nor yet the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath day, they have fulfilled them in condemning him. They didn't listen to the voice of the prophets. They didn't hear the voice of the prophets. We don't want to make that mistake. We want to hear the voice of the prophets. We want to learn from Malachi. I don't have to be a Jew living 400 years before Christ to gather some meaning from the book. What can I get? God is a great king. He deserves my best. He will not accept less. God wants me to listen to his word and let it sink down deep and bond it to my soul. Really pay attention to what he has to say for me. God wants me to honor my covenants. He wants me to think about how I treat my fellow man. Not just in that singular issue of divorce, but in every issue in life. He wants me to think about how I treat other people and realize we're all God's children. So it's incumbent upon me then to treat my fellow man in a way that's dignified. God has proven his love for us, and then he's made the church his elect. Now, I as an individual could choose to leave that group and no longer be among the elect, but God making us his elect as a group, that's a token of his love. And we owe him our service in return. Those are some things we can learn from Malachi's message, and I hope the study of the evening is interesting to you. Where do you stand with God today? Have you been loyal to him? Have you been faithful to him? Are you giving him your best? Have you even become a child of God? If you haven't, we want to give you the opportunity to do so right now. We'd love to help you with that. Or if you are a Christian, but you have not given the Lord your best, and you want to seek the Lord in prayer and try to draw closer to him, we'd love to help you in that way. If we can help you in either way, please come. Have a seat on the front pew while we stand and while we sing.